Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Save big money on your next project with help from Menards. Move water where you need it quickly with a Barracuda sump pump. Sump pumps keep your basement dry when big storms hit unexpectedly. Get a half horsepower cast iron Barracuda sump pump on sale now through May 5th. Hurry into Menards. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Everybody loves a lover. I'm a lover. Everybody loves me. Anyhow, that's how I feel. Wow, I feel just like a Pollyanna.
All right, here is our short informal introduction. Hello and welcome to another episode of the internationally acclaimed podcast In Bed with Nick and Megan. And by internationally acclaimed, I mean, I think it's pretty good. Starring the starry-eyed Nick Offerman.
Hola.
Today, all in Spanish. And his English-speaking wife, Megan Mullally. But, and today, featuring the glamorous, handsome, also starry-eyed, Mr. Alec Baldwin.
Woo!
Standing ovation in the studio.
Now, what I noticed, because we are your audience, now this is an audio podcast, right? We're only going to play the sound.
That's mm-hmm. right.
But because we're Zooming, as most people are, these days, I can see the two of you. And Nick, you look 15, 20 years younger. You look like you're ready to do the remake of G.I. Jane.
Holy shit. Thank
look at
you so
the
much.
Haircut, he's shaved. He looks like he looks focused.
Well, you know, Megan, I'm usually protected by an acting role, you know, playing whichever Mr. Natural happened to be on board with. But when I don't have a job, Megan has a couple of needs. One of them is she apparently doesn't like a face full of thistles to rub up against her face and other body regions. But also she says when my hair grows out, it makes my head look much too large. And so she likes to see my head shape.
You and I come from that same cranial school.
Oh, your head is gigantic.
We have a Celtic. We have what I call cinder head. It's like a cinder. It's a doorstop.
Yeah, it's truly an edifice.
In medieval times, they'd chop your head off and they'd use it as a doorstop. You know what I mean? For the castle, which was a heavy door. It's a heavy door.
You know, but I heard a long time ago that they say for real that a lot of famous people have gigantic heads, and you two are no exception.
Yeah, and Megan, you got a pretty normal size. You got a good sized head. You got a good sized head.
It's not
for a famous
tiny,
comedy chick. No. You have a decent sized head.
It's heaven's apricot.
Could you two be any more in love? It's just, it's magical.
Now, okay, I've lost track. Are there four extant children and one on the way, or three? and one on the way.
I'm going to name my next child Extant Baldwin. I love
that. name your next kid Extant Baldwin.
He's Extant. I have my older daughter, Ireland, from when I was married before. And then I have my wife, Ilari, and I have four children, and we're having another child. My wife is a collector. Some people collect cars. Some people collect coins and stamps. My wife collects babies. She likes to have babies.
You have the most adorable babies I've ever seen in my life. It's insane.
That's the problem, really. It really is true. You really like, once they become one and a half, and they start to kind of, you know, chime in with their opinion, and they start to, respond a certain way. We almost automatically look at each other at the same time and go, "Time to have another one." it's like a lease on a car. You know, it's like time to trade it in, get a new one.
Well, congratulations on the impending arrival.
Now, what are you two creative furnaces? I think of the two of you as two creative kind of thorium reactors of creativity. What are the two of you doing during the plague here? What are the two of you doing every day?
Well, I don't want to disappoint you, but we're not being as, you know, nearly as exciting as you've imagined. That's not to say it's a complete wash, but
at the moment, we are hosting international superstar Beefcake Alec Baldwin in our dining room, which honestly has been an incredible saving grace. We feel so lucky because the one thing that is making people crazy, the isolation and the sense of loneliness and sort of claustrophobia, we have the great fortune of defeating, because part of our job is making these podcast episodes. And so we get to have the most delightful guests over for a chat, which is making this a lot more palatable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I have a podcast that I've been doing for a while now, for like 8 or 9
years.
Yeah,
we were on it. We did a live thing with you in LA. That was so fun.
That was very successful. And, I enjoy, we're about to start recording remotely for the first time ever. We did one episode in season one by phone with a U.S. Senator, Alan Simpson, and it was a disaster and we hated it. So we never did that again. Everybody was in the studio. Everybody was face to face. And now we're about to do it this way, you know, the Zoom, so I can see them and read them. And we're going to start recording, I think next week, we're doing a bunch of,
we're doing
about 4 or 5 of them that way, because we have no choice. This is it. This is it.
Well, what are you, I mean, your podcast is great and we look forward to hearing those episodes. We normally do our podcast in our actual bed with the people, but can't do that right now.
Why aren't you in bed now? Why?
Oh,
just because of the rig.
Yeah, there's more equipment for this, strangely enough, than if we were in our actual bed.
When we do it in real life with in person, a couple of delightfully fragrant young engineers come and take care of the sound. So only when
only do it open the doors. So the virus has driven you out of the bed for the podcast.
That's right.
Yeah. Now, what do you do over there? Are you just chasing children around all day long, or are there other things happening?
The day is the same. The kids, which were normally up like 5:30, 6, now they're up at like 6, 6:30. Mm-hmm. And it's homeschooling. My wife is homeschooling them from 9 to 12. The two smaller ones take a nap, hopefully. Usually they do, but they usually, 80% of the time they get an hour or an hour and a half nap. And then they're up, and everything is weather dependent. So if Jesus Christ were to call me on the phone at 2:30 and say, "Alec, I have so much to tell you," I'd have to say, "I have to call you back, Jesus." Because if the sun is out, I say, "Thank you, Jesus, that the sun is out. Thank you for that." And we run out the door and we go do something outside. It really is that way, because what I feel is the duty I have, what I feel is the obligation we have, is to try to make them not realize how weird all this is. Because they're kind of catching on to it now. You know what I mean? Like, why can't they see their friends? And why are we doing the same thing a lot of the time? And it's really, they're doing great. And the homeschooling is going fairly well. I mean, I was reading this article online where they were saying how, you know, I'm reading an infinite number of articles related to this, where they were saying how the academics and the kind of ABCs of education for kids this age are becoming, are no less important, but as important is a kind of emotional security for kids. And a part of the academic day has to talk about how we manage their feelings, you know, because they sense that things aren't normal. You know what I mean? They sense that mommy and daddy are home all day, and daddy either wants to kiss mommy and buy her a diamond ring or throw her in a volcano. It varies from minute to minute. And like anybody where you're, you know, sequestered like this, it's weird. And we're doing great because we're out of the city. Mm-hmm. You know, all my friends who are stuck in New York, they're really like super unhappy. Because when you go out the door, you can't really distance as well. Like out here, it's perfectly safe and we're all good to go.
Yeah, and you have nature there, which is great. And how old is your oldest right now?
Carmen is 6. She'll be 7 in August. August 23rd, she'll be 7.
Wow.
And she's already like crashing my meetings on Zoom. She like sits on my lap in the middle of the meeting and I'm pitching something to the head of documentary, something very serious, like at CNN. And Carmen's like, hey, everybody. And she like sits in on the call and she just walks in my room. And you know, it's crazy.
So, Alec, you're such a funny person, funny guy. And I mean, I have to say of all the people I've worked with, I don't know that there's anyone that, I mean, there's certainly no one better than you. I'm tempted to say that you're the funniest and the most fun scene partner I've probably ever had.
Oh, that's so sweet of you to say.
Yeah.
That's so sweet of you.
I mean, we had so much fun on Will and Grace, and you did a lot. Well, you did a ton of episodes the last season of the first time around of Will and Grace, which was like 2005, 2006, that season.
Yeah.
You did like half the episodes. You did a live episode.
I did like
with
an
us.
Arc of them with you guys. But you know what's funny is that I think when you do, I'm not just saying this to be nice to you, it's when you do this stuff for a living and you work with people that you really like and respect. You know, like I've worked with people and it's all like what I call the rule of three. Everything is divided into thirds. One third of them I liked and loved and admired. One third of them I was like, meh, they're okay. And one third of them I wanted them to crash into a mountainside. You know what I mean? I just didn't really enjoy working with them at all. And and you're obviously at the tippy top of the first category where when I was with you, I mean, everybody says the same thing, which is, you know, you watch a show and you watch that character evolve and you're the textbook case. Someone said to me, it was like Lorne or Robert Carlock. They said, watch Megan season one of her show. And there was some shit she wasn't even like getting near. And then by the time it's season two and you're cut toward the end of season two, it's like, I got this. And you have all your thing, you know that character and you know what you want to do. And that evolution is thrilling. It's thrilling to watch. You know?
Oh, thanks, Alec. That's so nice. Yeah, it was weird because when I first started on Will and Grace at the very beginning, the character just wasn't written the way that it, I mean, it just wasn't the same character. I mean, they were writing it sort of like just your average wisecracking sidekick. And I feel like I was very consciously trying to bring in anything I could think of that was kind of quirky. And so I would bring in, you know, this or that. And then they would normally like the things that I did, and then they sort of wrote to that, and then the character evolved into, you know, really original, a much more original character. So that was kind of fun. It was nice that it eventually got to that point. And then you came back and did a bunch of episodes in the revival, during the revival of Will and Grace. And gosh, it was so much fun. I remember we did two episodes. Didn't we do, we did two episodes of yours in 2 days, I think, at one point. And we did that scene where we have sex without touching each other.
Well, can I tell you something? What happened was, when I tell people this story, this is perhaps the most preposterous thing that's ever happened in my career. And that is, my wife said to me, I don't want you to kiss or have simulated sex with other women in your career. And I was like, well, the good news is, I mean, the convenient thing about that is I'm, at that point, I was rounding the corner toward 55. So I was more likely to play the cop with a nightstick that tapped on the windshield and stopped two other people from making out in a car. I used to make out with the girl in the car, and now I'm the cop on the beat, so forth. But, you know, my wife had a point. She was like, I mean, I don't know where they've been, and you're going to kiss me and you're going to be with me. And I don't know how you show business people do this, but that's not cool with me. And I was like, okay. I mean, I was in love with my wife, and I said, and they called me about coming to do the show with you. And I said, to Max and Cohan, I said, I can't make out with Megan. I can't kiss Megan. I can't have anything to do with Megan that way, because my wife doesn't want me to do that. And I kind of get it. We've got kids, and I'm kissing my kids. And it was nothing specific to you. It just was in general. And Muchnick was like, aha, okay, huh, really, interesting, okay. And then he comes back, and we do that show where it's all like, you like, aren't you going to miss this? You started doing all those filthy pantomime you were doing. Yeah. And it was great.
I know. They told me that story, that there was a moratorium on you, you know, touching or kissing any other actresses ever again. And I did think that was such a funny fix. Yes. And it ended up being a lot funnier than probably a million other things we could have.
Oh my God, it was hysterical.
Tried.
It was hysterical.
Oh, yeah, best. It really was fun.
Now, and Nick, that was... Nick, no, because go ahead. That was what?
Well, I was going to say, and then also in that same episode, the actor, Charles Stevenson, who played the character of Smitty,
yes,
the bartender, you know, he had been on a million episodes, but always trapped behind the bar. And they finally, that episode with you was the first time they got him out from behind the bar and had him come in and do, we were kind of making out with each other via Smitty. Like we would make out with Smitty and
then
he'd pass it on. So, you know, that was when everyone discovered that he is actually kind of brilliant. Comedically, like we always loved him and thought he was so funny, but it was sort of a one trick pony because he always had to do the same joke over and over.
I love that episode.
And then he kind of burst out. Yeah, it was nice for him too.
But that leads to the other awkward moment where we're out on the set and you've got that cavernous set there, and off to one side is the video village and the powers that be and all their guests seated in a little spot there. As you're facing the stages, obviously, to the right of that and the sets. And my wife is there with a couple of her friends. And the moment I had to walk up to my wife and go, does that include the old man? Am I not allowed to kiss the old man as well?
Yeah.
And she was like, yes, that includes the old man as well. So I had to kiss him on the cheek, like adjacent to his mouth, and cover it up. I had to cover it up with my shoulder like it was like I was Gable, you know what I mean, kissing Vivian Leigh.
Oh, funny.
A very muscular kiss.
You know? I love it.
Oh, I missed that one. I didn't catch that in
Nick,
the moment.
Nick, what's the greatest, among the greatest moments for you? I mean, I can honestly say, you know, 30 Rock, we had a lot of fun. There's a countless memories there. But guesting on shows, because I've done some of that. And some of those shows I did, they weren't fun. They were okay. But sure. Will and Grace, I had a ball only because I worshiped Megan. What was fun for you?
Well, before I answer that question, I want to say and I can't remember if I mentioned this when we did your podcast, but if so, forgive me. But when I was in high school, I had this girlfriend, and we had one of those tempestuous, like deeply romantic relationships, a forever relationship. And I learned in this relationship about, it was the first time that I had sort of fallen, you know, that hard and that puppy love kind of way. And I learned about jealousy, where some situations occurred to where she, you know, she went to the beach with a couple of guys one time or whatever. And I learned about jealousy, and that the answer to defeating jealousy was to simply to commit myself and give myself to the maintenance of my relationship in a way that I never need to worry. That, like, I'm always aware of the health of the relationship enough that she would never stray. And we were together for a few years. And from that day forward, I said, this is great. I'm never going to worry about another guy, except Alec Baldwin.
Wow. Highest compliment I've ever been paid.
This is like 1987. I was like, if you know, crazily, we ever run into Alec Baldwin, I would rather you didn't maybe, you know, go see a movie with that guy.
And me so back I'm, then. Yeah, me back then. Yeah.
Oh, Christ.
I had it all going on back then.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
If you look up hirsute in the encyclopedia, there's a whole other volume with just pictures of your forearms.
As Pete Davidson said on SNL one time, he said that they showed up pictures of me before and after. They showed me when I was young and they showed me now. And he said, you look like you're like a log that's been floating in the ocean for a couple of years.
It comes
you've
to
taken on a lot of water.
No, you're still devastatingly handsome.
Now that we're you need your prescription checked. Now that we're being so candid, I want you to know that when we did our scenes together, Nick, and I admire you too, and I mean you are her husband, and I have nothing but respect for you and your wife, but I want you to know that even though we did not have any physical contact that way, I did say to her, I don't want to lie to you. I said, under normal circumstances, if we were doing this the way we normally would, my tongue would be in your spinal column right about now. I
mean, yeah. Sure.
I came right out and I said that to your wife. I'm sorry.
I've seen movies.
And you know, when we, in the, I'm sorry, what?
I've seen movies. I know how it works.
And so,
Alec. I've seen Pride of Lions.
So do you remember there was an episode back in, you know, the eighth season of Will and Grace, which was, you know, 2006-ish, where your character, Malcolm and Karen, our characters, go on a double date with Grace and whoever her boyfriend was at the time. And the joke is that we are sitting in a booth, right? You know, we're sitting right across from them in a booth, and we are wildly making out the entire time to the extent that they can't eat. You know, I mean, it's super gross. Okay, so I never, like, just historically, like, when there's supposed to be a kiss and something, I don't really, like, completely go for it. But I thought, well, I kind of have to do it with this because, you know, that's the whole joke. So I was prepared to do that. But then when we got to the night of the taping, okay, so we're shooting the scene, and not only is Nick standing directly in front of the set, sandwiched in between the four cameras that you shoot a sitcom with.
Yeah.
He's in my eye line.
And
he's lit, and
they had him light him. They put a light on.
Yes, like a pin spot. Right. And standing with, both of them looking directly at us, your agent at the time, who happened to be my ex-husband.
Right. Catcher.
Yeah. So that my big chance to make out, like fully make out with Alec Baldwin was cruelly squelched.
I think behind them was your therapist as well.
Yeah.
Was your therapist.
Yeah, all of my ex-boyfriends.
Your ex-husband and your
mom.
And Father Tony.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Save big money and start your spring project with help from Menards. We offer a huge selection of body plants, veggies, and herbs to plant at home and grow yourself. Right now, all 4.5-inch Bonnie plants are on sale through May 5th. Head to the Menards Garden Center to get your garden growing and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
They say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.
So, Nick, so what was, like, the most fun job you've ever had? Or I should say among?
Well, gosh.
The TV series? Was the TV series tons of fun?
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, much the same. Something came across my plate the other day where there was a bunch of memes of my character, Ron Swanson, and your character, Jack Donaghy, like, with a wonderful juxtaposition. Yes. There are certain similarities where those genius goddamn writers did such an incredible job of using our the granite hewn foibles that we were born with for the most incredible comedy fodder. And so getting to work with those writers on Parks and Rec and the cast, and, you know, so one of the most incredible things happened. Maybe this has become de rigueur by now, but when we started that show, which we shot our first episodes in the spring of 2009, I believe, Greg Daniels, our co-creator and of the American Office fame, came to the cast and he said, "Look, we're not burning film here. We're shooting on digital media, so we no longer have the problem of like every frame is not precious, and so." You're all hired for the rich flavors that you bring to this particular goulash. So anything, you know, we've written these scripts, we've labored over them. We want to try to make them work. But any idea that you have, I just want you all to feel free. You can try it. Like, you're not going to get in trouble. If you something occurs to you that you think is a great idea. And he gave us permission on the very first day before we rolled a frame. And, you know, especially hearing stories from Megan about what things were like in the 90s when she's done all these pilots and sitcoms, when, like, if you deviated, if you turned an and into a but, you were fired, like, where the script was considered bulletproof. And so to be in that atmosphere of playfulness and freedom without punishment, of course, you know, as you can imagine, with a cast of 8 regulars, the first 2 episodes, we all masturbated furiously and said, I think I'm going to spend 3 minutes making a hilarious sandwich in the middle of this dialogue. And we quickly learned, okay, that there's a certain point where it becomes too much. But
yeah, they,
by God,
they
it was
generally
fun.
Like, even though you would do that at the end of a scene, you would do a take or two where you could experiment. They generally didn't really use that much of that, right?
I'd say in any given episode, there was probably 5 moments that came from.
Well, that's more than I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because what happened is it got boiled down to where everybody would just went crazy, and then we saw the first cut. And we said, oh, we don't have time to be fucking around like this. So only if you had an idea or an inspiration, you would really say, okay, I think this is golden. Like, this could make the show. Then you would sneak it in. But other
than
that,
do the two of you have an overlapping demographic? Like, do people walk up and go, "Oh my God, it's Karen from Will and Grace," and you go, "And this is my husband Nick," and they're like, "Oh, hi." And they have no idea who you are, or the opposite, where they're like, "Oh my God, yeah. It's Ron Swanson. This is my wife, Megan. Oh.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. Like, a lot of his fans know me as the character I played on his show.
Oh, I see.
Because I played his ex-wife, Tammy. And so a lot of people know me from that. It's a little bit of everything. I mean, there's some people who don't know anything about him. There's some people who don't realize that we're married or that we even know each other. It's sort of interesting. But Alec, what's your favorite job that you ever had?
Gosh, I mean, I did this movie once called The Edge, which was not a good movie.
Oh my God, I was going to ask you about this.
Well, when it started out, it was weird because Mamet had written a film that was very much of a psychological thriller. It was called Bookworm. And Tony's character was obsessed with books and reading, and he was this very intellectual and kind of nerdy guy, even though he was this Warren Buffett-esque billionaire. And
this is Anthony Hopkins.
He married to Elle Macpherson. And the movie was much more psychological and baroque and weird exchanges of dialogue. And the director, whatever he didn't really get or understand, he cut. So we're there on the set in the Canadian Rockies, and he was from New Zealand. And he'd say, "Well, this exchange they've got on page 14 here, it does tend to go on a bit with the dialogue. I thought maybe we cut the first four speeches here. Page 29, he does tend to ramble on a bit here." And I thought, "Oh, wow, you know, that way that Dave is rambling on is the very reason I'm here, quite frankly." So whatever he didn't kind of understand how to play it or direct it, he just cut. And he wound up turning the movie ultimately into more of an action-adventure film than a psychological thriller. But I discovered the Canadian Rockies. I discovered Banff, all of Alberta. We shot everywhere. We shot in every corner of Alberta. We started rehearsals in August, where we had to wear bug repellent in the national park, the provincial park we shot in the beginning. And by the time we finished in right around U.S. Thanksgiving, we finished in Edmonton. It was 30 below zero. So we experienced a 100-degree temperature change.
Wow.
In 1996. And it was when we landed, we did a scene where we helicoptered to the top of Assiniboine, which is a big mountain peak. And when you look down south from there, you're literally looking down the ridge, like the back of a triceratops. It's like you're looking along the spine of an animal going down, which is the Rocky Mountains heading south toward the U.S. And I burst into tears. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen in my life, you know, covered in snow. And I loved, that was 1996, so it was a long time ago. That was the greatest time I've ever had. I was working with Tony, I worshipped. I mean, he was my idol. And the movie, you know, they did not make a great film. There's a lot of good things there. The greatest thing about the film, other than Tony, was they had, and Mamet's writing, the writing that survived, was Jerry Goldsmith did the music. It was beautiful music.
I love that movie so much. It's Alec and Anthony Hopkins and a bear in the Canadian Rockies. But what I was going to ask you a question about this movie, because I'm such a sappy romantic, and I love being outside, and I love, so one of the great things about Parks and Recreation was anytime we'd go shoot in the woods, Chris Pratt, who's a hunter, and I would be in heaven, and the rest of the cast would hate it. They hated being out where there's bugs and, you know, no air conditioning. But so that's always my dream. But I've learned by working in the business, you know, that like if we see a horse and carriage in a Howard's End, like some period movie, going across the British countryside, I say, "Oh my God, what a day of work to get to shoot that, to drive that coach and four and so forth." And then you got to be careful, because when your wish comes true, sometimes it's 93 degrees and they give you four layers of period wool and the horses are assholes and so forth and so on, or there's no cushion, your tailbone takes a beating.
Yeah.
And so my question was going to be, for me, that the Edge is one of the most dreamy jobs I could ever imagine. And I was going to ask you, would you talk me out, based on that, like the reality versus the fantasy, would you talk me out of chasing that job? Or would you recommend the experience?
The greatest example of what you're saying, oddly, it's so funny you should say that, because Harold Perrineau, who's an African-American actor everybody knows from Lost and all these TV shows he's done, and he's the sweetest guy. I love him. I love Harold. He was great. And Harold plays the character who we're in rehearsals, and he was joking because we were talking about how they're going to shoot his death scene. He gets eaten by a bear. And Harold says that when he first read the script, he was like, Alec Baldwin, Anthony Hopkins, and Harold Perrineau. I wonder which one the bear's going to eat first. So we get to the scene. We get to the scene where Harold is chewed upon, and we weren't there. We get the night off, and they shoot. And they shoot it in the woods, in the forest there, and it's freezing cold. And they put the pipes up to make it rain, and they put Harold's body inside the animatronic mouth of the masticating bear, and the bear is going like this, like snapping its head from side to side and torquing like some horrible ride at an amusement park. And Harold's getting just the living shit beaten out of him by this scene. He's getting completely overwhelmed. And I just looked at him the next day, and I heard it was a really tough night. And I said, you know, Harold, always remember that script always reads better when you're tucked in your bed in Brooklyn.
It's so true.
You know, you gotta say to yourself, there's movies I want to see and there's movies I want to make.
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like people don't, you know, people don't really realize that something that will take one sentence to write in a script can take 6 days to shoot.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a little different. Now wait, before we get too far away from the we're talking about movies, before we get too far away from the idea of making out with people, I happen to know that back in the day, and I don't want to get you in trouble at home, but I happen to know that back in the day, a lot of actors when doing, you know, sex scenes, like shit happened. Did you ever have any experiences like that? Or?
What are you driving at, Megan? What are you
I'm
driving
saying
at?
That sometimes...
What are your notes? What are your notes
sometimes
telling
the,
you?
She's asking, what
sometimes
were you driving
the,
at?
Sometimes the... Yes, who were you driving at is what I'm asking. Sometimes it wasn't as play pretend as we'd like to... as we've been led to believe.
I did a movie once I'll never forget, and I did this very tepid little thriller with Nicole Kidman. And Harold Becker was the director, and Harold had a very raspy voice, very heavy New York dialect. It was, you know, Harold Becker, who did Sea of Love with Pacino and so forth. He did Taps. He did a lot of good movies. And Harold, who I really liked a lot, I loved Harold, he was indicating to me that in the scene, Nicole is in the other room with Bill Pullman, and he says, and she has to be... she can't sleep. She can't go to sleep because of the sound of you having sex. You have to be having this very, very, convulsive sex with this woman who was Deborah Ferrantino, Jimmy Ferrantino, who died, his wife, who I knew for years, who was a lovely woman. I loved Debbie Ferrantino. And I knew her from when she was on soaps and so forth, years like I was. And we do the scene. Of course, we're very chaste and you don't want to get anything wrong and you don't want to be some kind of a cretin. And Harold comes in and says, Alec, you've got to be banging her right through the headboard. He said, Nicole has to be up and she can't sleep because of the sound. You guys got to be going crazy here. And so she and I just looked at each other and we were like, oh, God. Oh, God. And we did the greatest approximation of a sex scene I think I've ever been involved with in my life.
I love that. That's so funny. Well, I wanted to ask you about Saturday Night Live because, first of all, you know that I take full credit for your entire career as a sitcom star.
Yes.
Just as a sitcom star. Because based on your hostings of SNL up to that point, in the early 2000s, when we were doing Will and Grace the first time around, I kept haranguing the producers of Will and Grace to hire you. And they did. And then right after that, you did 30 Rock. So I'm taking full credit for all of it. But what about hosting SNL? Because aren't you tied for all time most hostings with maybe Steve Martin?
Even if Steve Martin hosted 40 shows, his shows weren't as good as the shows.
Sure.
I don't think it's about numbers. It's not about quantity. It's about quality.
Yes.
Oh, I mean, Steve Martin, who gives a shit about him? You know what I mean?
Flavorless.
Yeah. It's a kind of a dry toast kind of a thing. It's kind of a crusty old baguette of comedy. But I actually give you credit going way past that. Megan, I don't know if you remember, but I was offered the role of Batman and I called you and you said, no, don't do that. Don't play Batman. You know, and
no.
You don't remember when I was offered Batman and I called you and you talked me out of it?
Oh, God.
And then I got offered to play Iron Man and all those roles. I think, what is Robert Downey made now? Like 150, 200 million?
He's
and I called you and you
up.
Said, oh, don't do that. Iron Man's so boring. You don't want to be Iron Man.
I didn't talk you out of that.
No, but you did talk me, you did put the spell on me that a comedy is a blast. And I sat with you and you described the week. Well, yours was a four camera. Mine was a single camera. I failed to discern the specific difference between the two. So when I went to do my show, it wasn't driving a bucket of golf balls like your show was by comparison. Mm. But I went to go do. But you did have a huge role in that. You did make me see that it could involve some skill and craft and whatever and be fun. And 30 Rock, which was stressful sometimes because it was single camera, so it was long days. And we always, we shot everything. So Tina and the network was like, not, you know, attacking her, but they did chime in every now and then that if Tina wrote a story and you were sitting there with her and someone would say to Liz Lemon, how was your date last night? And rather than describe the date, they'd whip pan and they'd shoot the date. They'd shoot it. So they shot everything. And they were, and everything, and there was a lot of complaining about the cost of that. Like, why can't you just tell it rather than shoot it? So we did have, you know, tandem units and a lot of people working really, really hard there, but it was a blessing across the board. But I do owe in large part the decision to do that experience to you.
Oh, that's really,
yeah.
Well, that's very nice. I'm actually taking credit even beyond that for the joy that you've brought the world with your comedy. I would really put your comedic timing up against any ones that I mean.
Isn't that funny you say that? Because I don't view myself as funny. I don't.
Oh my God.
I view myself as someone who says the lines well, you know, like I'll never forget Roger Daltrey. I always use the same quote. Roger Daltrey said, no one writes songs like Pete, meaning Townsend. He goes, and no one sings Pete songs like I do. You know, so I'm saying the lines that other people wrote. You know, I'm not a comedian because I don't write.
Well, you're incredibly funny. I mean, you're funny in real life, but I think that you're onto something there because I've always said that there's really not that much difference between comedy and drama. In comedy, the only thing that separates it from drama is that you have to play it like drama, but you have to go too far. Like that's what makes it funny. I think that, you know, when you're sad, you're the saddest anyone's ever been on the planet. And when you're happy, the same. And I think that is an element of what you're saying, you know, that you're, it's like exaggerated drama.
I think that we're both blessed with great writers, you know, all three of us. Mm-hmm. Parks and Rec was well-written, well-oiled ship, great group of people. You got to have the right people. I'm the firm believer. Paul McCartney once said to me that Ringo Starr had to go and do a bunch of gigs that he owed when he was in the Beatles in the early days. And they said to him, you know, we got to get into the studio and record a couple songs. And they brought in this drummer to replace him because Starr was, you know, had to leave. And they brought in a guy to come in and they said, oh, this guy's like the hottest drummer in all of London, you know, and we're going to bring this guy in to play. And And he came in and he played, and he was, you know, one of the greatest drummers in all of London. And they said, you know, we don't want to do it with him. You know, it's the four of us and that's it. That's it. It's that chemistry. And I really believe if you took one, if Jane Krakowski didn't play Jenna, if Jack McBrayer didn't play his part of the five principals and including some of the more supporting roles, you know, but of the five principals, if it wasn't those five people, you can never guarantee it would have been successful. I mean, an ensemble is an ensemble. Yeah. And I'm a firm believer that Lutz, you know, if John didn't play Lutz, it would have been different. It would have been the show would have been like a little gyroscopically different, you know. And mm-hmm. what we've all been blessed with is the three of us is we've been on shows where they got exactly the right people to play those parts. Exactly.
Yeah.
What do you think is going to happen now, post pandemic, with that business, the business of making television and making movies?
Well, I wonder, I spoke to somebody who talked about in some kind of really admittedly exaggerated way. I mean, they were being very exaggerated. They said, hey, listen, man, if things don't get, you know, if we don't get, you know, forget about a vaccine. If we don't get into a more predictable model by September, they said, you know, what are we going to do? We're going to put up mobile homes on the set of Fox and have the crew test for COVID, and everybody comes on the lot and you don't leave.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And they feed you and you live there and you can't see your family and you can't go anywhere. And we all get isolated and locked down like we're in the army, and they rotate them every 3 or 4 weeks. One part of the crew goes home. They work 4 weeks. They go home. Another group comes and works 4 weeks and they go home, and we shoot and shoot and shoot and shoot. Let's say you're doing a movie. Let's say you're doing a streaming series where it's like, you know, and everybody's going to have to get tested and have their temperature taken every day that they walk in the building. But you're not going to be able to leave and go outside to the outside world. And I thought, boy, that's, you know, as crazy as it sounds, I'd sign up for that for a period of time because we got to go to work. We got to go to work, you know.
Well, I just think it's going to be tricky to get people to, you know, spend that amount of time without being with their families. I mean, you'd have to move the whole family into some kind of situation.
Yeah, but the thing is that if your kids aren't going to school, if society is still locked down to some degree, or there's some limitations, we're out here on Long Island, and we're thinking if the kids aren't going to go to school in the fall, we're going to stay here. And I've got friends of mine that are thinking about putting their kids in school out here. And I'm thinking, well, if we're out here, we'll just put the kids online with their school again, because it's like when you're online, it doesn't matter whether we're in Vienna or Argentina, who gives a shit? Now, with that idea, this guy was telling me, he was saying how everybody would be away from their families for a specified amount of time. So let's say the shoot was 10 weeks or 12 weeks. So you'd have three crews working for 4 weeks each. Mm-hmm. So that you'd come in, you'd make some money, go home. And other people would have the option to sign on for the whole 12 weeks. You want to stay for 12 weeks, like you're in the army or in the Navy and you're deployed?
Yeah, if you're single. Yeah.
If you're single and you want to make the money, you know, they're going to come up with something.
Yeah, and if they write the script in such a way that your storyline is only with, say, two other actors, then they could shoot out your entire storyline.
Yeah.
In a shorter amount of time.
It's either that or Nick and I have a show together, which is where we tattoo our private parts live on camera, which I think a lot of people would want to. I think a lot of people would want to get into that.
It's weird because you guys have been doing that throughout this whole podcast, and I really do think that
I told you we should have rolled on it.
We should have. Yeah. I told you don't turn off that camera.
Oh, man.
You said, no, let's turn this off. It's not right.
Another missed opportunity.
Well, listen, I want to say my love to you. You say words like extant and de rigueur, and I want to just blow you both a kiss and say my love to you.
That's so sweet.
Nick.
Well, let me just say that this has been another incredible installment of In Bed with Nick and Megan with the glorious Alec Baldwin. Alec, you were saying to Nick?
My love to you, Nick.
My love to you, Alec. It's so great to talk to you.
And I don't need to say I love you again to you, Megan. I've said it so many times.
I think, we've had plenty of that content.
Alec, there's still time for us, is all I'm going to say.
There's still spinal fluid to be plumbed.
There's still time. We're both still breathing. So you never know what's right around the corner, is all I will say. Good night.
In Bed with Nick and Megan is an Earwolf production. It's produced by Megan Mullally, Kevin Bartelt, and Michael Landry. Executive produced by Colin Anderson and Chris Bannon. Music by Nancy and Beth, which can be found at www.nancyandbeth.com. If you enjoyed In Bed with Nick and Megan, make sure to rate it and review the show on Apple Podcasts.
NetCredit is here to say yes, because you're more than a credit score. Apply in minutes and get a decision as soon as the same day. Loans offered by NetCredit or lending partner banks and serviced by NetCredit. Application subject to review and approval. Learn more at netcredit.com/partners. NetCredit. Credit to the people.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
They say plants like music. Yeah, no, like really, they respond to the vibrations of it, which means that this playlist you're listening to, the plants are too. You know what else plants like? Organic soil from Miracle-Gro. It's made with all the best stuff like wood fiber and compost. Plus, it's OMRI certified organic, which officially means it's made with superior ingredients. And when you give your plants the stuff that makes them happy, they won't judge you on your iffy playlist.
Hear that, plants?
So go ahead and give them Miracle-Gro.